happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Yeah, that's right.
Telling me I got to beware. Each time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
One more time.
Each time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
That's right, boy, P.E., full effect, boy, until the year 2000, yo.
Stop, look, what's that sound?
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. We're doing a live show today. The show today, Election 2004, Bush and Bush Light. And I have to thank Ralph Schoenman for coming up with that title. That's a hit, Ralph.
Thank you, Bonnie. It's the theme of the Million Worker Mobilization and the struggle onward. We need something besides Bush and Bush Light if we're going to move forward in this society.
Ralph and I are joined today by Doug McDonald. Doug McDonald is the founder of the Community Labor Alliance. He's chair of the Outreach Committee of the Million Worker March. And Doug has challenged Solano County's purchase of Diebold voting machines. Welcome, Doug.
Hi, Bonnie. Thank you.
I guess this is your virgin flight on Guns and Butter, right?
Yes, it is. Indeed. Indeed.
And, of course, welcome to you, Ralph.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Ralph's an author. He's co-producer of Taking Aim on our sister station WBAI in New York, along with Maya Schoen. And Ralph is the chair of the Communications Publicity Committee for the Million Worker March. Isn't that right, Ralph?
Yes, Bonnie, and Maya would be with us today, but she's finishing up a news bulletin for Local 21, the Professional and Engineers Union, of which she's communications director, addressing some of the issues that we're going to be talking about today.
I know. They keep her busy. She doesn't get in here often enough.
Right. Part of the struggle.
Well, here we are. It's the day after the election, and it was only yesterday and the days before that I was hearing widespread predictions that this race was not going to be settled for months to come. There was going to be a battle. Everything was going to be challenged. We're going to end up in court. And yet today, the day after the election, Kerry has conceded that he lost the election to George W. Bush. You know, I was watching television last night a little bit, and I believe it was the Fox Channel, where a commentator, actually a pollster who conducts exit polls, and I believe they were speaking about Ohio, and the exit polls were showing Kerry 4 and 5 percentage points ahead of Bush, and yet when the actual vote came in, Kerry was losing. And this pollster said, well, you know, we're going to have to do away with these exit polls because they don't work anymore. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Exit polls used to work, but they don't work anymore. Now, I know that a lot of these voting machines have been put in across the country, voting machines that provide no paper trail, that can be easily hacked, that the software that utilize proprietary software owned by Republican operatives. Doug, you've done a lot of work with Diebold, haven't you, and some of these voting machines?
Yes, myself, many members of the community, the union movement in Solano County, all began working to agitate and advocate for the removal of the Diebold touchscreen machines in the winter of last year. Interestingly enough, I first found out about these machines in the county because the restaurant where the Community Labor Alliance had been meeting was actually set to hold a public demonstration of this technology. So here they were right on our doorstep. Of course, we had done a lot of research in the past to ascertain just exactly what these machines can do and have done. And the long story short, in the final analysis, these machines are incredibly open to manipulation. The election tabulation software is privately owned and cannot be scrutinized by the public, by any governmental body. Therefore, we really don't understand how these votes are being counted, nor is there any paper trail in the majority of these touchscreen machines.
I think this is not a new issue, although it's certainly an important one. You'll remember in elections in the Bay Area, a very substantial number of the boxes containing the votes were found in the Bay. Fraud is inherent in the structure of capitalist control. I mean, we have to continually remind ourselves and keep in mind what we're addressing here. 1% of the population owns more than 95% of the population combined. And the two political parties are funded from the same quarters. And the defining issues, as they are presented, are reflective of nothing more than the agenda of the one big property party with two names. That's the fundamental fraud, not to mention the fact that the process of communication and of issues and of voting is entirely within the control of banks and corporations. Bear something in mind, though, when we look at this issue of fraud. I mean, Greg Palast, who is a journalist at Liberal, has been documenting, for example, with specific respect to Ohio. He estimated it's something in the order of 1 million votes had already been cooked through manipulation of the eligible votes and the discarding of registered voters in advance of the election. Undoubtedly true. But in the larger picture, and this is hardly true. I mean, John Kennedy, when he ran against Richard Nixon in 1960, well, most of the cemeteries of Chicago voted under Richard Daley.
Yes.
That election was stolen fair and square, as they say. This is not a new phenomenon. The technology may be new, but the process under capitalist control is hardly so.
Yes, let me be clear. When we decided to campaign on this issue, it wasn't because we had any belief that by getting rid of these machines, the electoral system would somehow magically represent the will of the majority. And that all of its problems would be put aside. No, we stood up on this issue based on the principle that, you know, this is a direct threat to representative democracy in its grossest form, which is overtly veiling how these ballots are being counted. We had no belief that just by getting rid of these machines it would cure this problem. But interestingly enough, not a single member of the Democratic Council in the county ever bothered to get involved in this campaign.
And Doug, this campaign, as Doug is indicating, Bonnie, was launched under an organization of which Doug was the founder, the Community Labor Alliance. And as you know, we've spoken together on platforms of the Community Labor Alliance in relation to the false flag of 9/11 and the structure of power in the United States, together with labor activists and so on. And so that certainly, as Doug indicates, this is not out of the illusion that if you fix the machines, you fix the electoral process in corporate capitalist America. Nonetheless, a stolen election and the attempts to do so is not a minor matter. But it's part of the larger fundamental fraud, and it doesn't really address the question. When we've been listening to the Pacifica election analysis and the, you know, this fixation on the question of whether this vote or that vote was properly monitored fails to address the issue as follows. You know, we have in this society an electoral process in which 70 to 80% of the voting population who are eligible to vote are not participating in this. And there's not a negative reason entirely to explain that. Now, for example, there's been much hype, and largely through the bourgeois media, about how there's this enormous turnout in this election. The youth vote has been galvanized. Well, you know, 6.5 million youth voters in this election, 17 million in the last one. Let's be clear about this. They represent that there were significant increases in the percentage of voters participating. They started out claiming that in some instances it was a 70% of the registered electorate. In fact, they've now acknowledged that it's dramatically less than that. But even conceding 60%, that's 60% of the registered electorate, which is at best 52-53% of the eligible electorate, that's 30% of those eligible to vote in the United States who are participating in what's called a gigantic turnout. What that tells us is something fundamental. Poor people, the oppressed, African Americans, Latinos, poor whites, union families, One of the things that emerged in the discussion today, Bonnie and Doug, was that one out of three families participating in this process have a member who is unemployed. I mean, a person, a breadwinner, unemployed. One out of three. And they don't get counted amongst the unemployment rolls after 12 or 14 weeks, and they disappear as an unemployed category. What that signifies, I think it's important to point out, is that these two parties, which have an agenda that does not address the needs of working people, cannot galvanize people to come out and participate because there's nothing out there for them. It's not stupidity and it's not indifference. It's not even anything that could be called backwardness, this side of a certain elitist contempt. It's because people have too much common sense. We cannot galvanize that sleeping giant, which is the vast mass of the American people, by handing them the choice of Bush and Bush Light. The Democratic Party, notwithstanding the profound illusions that people who profess to be on the left, and I really have to say very candidly, this is the limits of liberalism, the Democratic Party is a corporate institution and has been such for nearly 100 years. It will never change its function. Where else in the world, brothers and sisters, do you find a society? I challenge anyone, whether in Latin America, Asia, the Middle East, or in Europe, in which the working class has no political expression other than the corporate parties. Leave aside the reformism of some of these social democratic parties. Where is there a society in which working people don't have a party based on trade unions, don't have a party, some form of political expression for the mass of the population? In this society, we're confined to the parties of capital.
Ralph, you know, I was listening to a little bit of Ralph Nader's speech this morning on C-SPAN. He gave a speech last night at the press club in Washington, D.C. He was pointing out that 95% of the seats in Congress in both houses are owned by the incumbent, either Republican or Democrat, and the districts are all gerrymandered to send the incumbent back, whether it be Democrat or Republican. He also went on to point out that, as you were saying, 40% of the families in this country live in poverty. He also talked about, among many, many other things, a group of 12 Muslim American organizations that banded together to support John Kerry for president. They got a hold of him. They wanted to meet with him. John Kerry refused to meet with them. Then they said, well, how about a phone call? He refused to talk to them on the phone. So Ralph Nader was very lit up about this. He kept saying, it's over, it's over, it's over. There's no republic. There's no voting for anybody who has any differences.
Yeah, Ralph Nader is a great man. I'm a great admirer of Ralph.
Speaking of Ralph, there goes his cell
goes,
phone again.
There goes that cell phone, which I will shut off, brothers and sisters.
Yeah, Ralph Nader is a wonderful man. I greatly admire him. However, we have to look, what was he building during this campaign run? Well, 4 years ago, he did have the nomination of the Green Party and was actually standing on their platform. This time around, he wasn't building anything. His campaign from the very beginning, in the final analysis, shows that the way Dennis Kucinich and other liberals in the Democratic Party simply tried to pressure the Democrats from within, that's what Ralph Nader was doing from without. He was trying to apply the pressure to get them to become more accountable and more liberal. He advised Kerry on how to garner and to gain the progressive and liberal votes here. When a person is running for president, he does not advise his challenger on how to win and how to gain more votes. In the final analysis, Ralph offered us nothing as far as an independent way forward. He was building no organization, and that organization needs to be built, and it needs to be a political expression of the working class.
You know what, Doug? Even so, he went on, Ralph Nader went on to talk about how he was attacked by the Democratic Party, threatened by Democratic operatives. They didn't let up on him.
I think all of that is true, Bonnie. I mean, look, a middle class response to the Democrats with the notion that you're somehow going to bring back the New Deal is an illusion which does not lead forward for a number of very fundamental reasons, i.e., first of all, of course, the New Deal was nothing other than an attempt to co-opt a totally mobilized working class that had formed a Congress of Industrial Organizations with mass sit-ins and strikes across the United States, the great factory occupations that led to the formation of the United Auto Workers and the Congress of Industrial Organizations. This was a crisis for capitalism. It cried out for a political expression. New Deal was designed to channel all that into a safe Democratic Party arena. The moment that happens, you have no strike pledges and the rollback of all the gains, and that's the name of this operation. Look, let's just take a quick gander at what the Democratic Party and Kerry offered people in this election. Knight Ritter described it as follows: it's boom time for billionaires. And they proceeded, along with the Wall Street Journal of August 4th, to identify the names of 200 billionaires, financiers, and corporate executives who defined, supported, and funded the Kerry candidacy and campaign. And when John Kerry went before the Detroit Economic Club, he made a very clear delineation of what his candidacy and what the party of which he represented stood for. He said that this candidacy was to defend the interests of Wall Street, the banks, and the corporations, explicitly in those words. He stated that his chief economic advisors, Warren Buffett, were guiding California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. He cited Lee Iacocca, who crafted the Bush economic agenda in the 2000 campaign. He presented David Bonderman, the founding partner of Texas Pacific Group, whose fortune, by the way, came from the bankruptcies of Continental Airlines and American West. And then he presented, and by the way, his money comes also from a leveraged buyout of Enron. And then he presents Osley Brown of Brown Foreman, a registered Republican all my life, Brown indicates, looking for the leadership that Senator Kerry will provide in fiscal matters. And then his financial team, Kerry's financial team, presented to the Detroit Economic Club, quote, Bank of America Chairman Charles Gifford, August A. Bush IV, President of Anheuser-Busch, Peter Sherman, second in command of Robert Murdoch's News Corporation, which is, as everyone knows, slightly to the right of Genghis Khan, Jeff Brotman of Costco Wholesale Corporation, Fred Kleisner, head of Wyndham Hotels, and thank you very much for the hotel workers on strike right now, the principal financial backers of Bush in 2000, every single one of these people. The Wall Street Journal then publishes a declaration by Kerry entitled, My Economic Policy, a new CEO in Washington will be good for American business. Once again, Warren Buffett, Lee Iacocca, and Robert Rubin are joining my campaign because they understand that American corporations will do better if we change the CEO. I will cut corporate taxes by 5% and provide a corporate tax break for 99% of tax-paying corporations, quote unquote. On November 2nd, John Kerry concluded, we shall have a national shareholders meeting, unquote. Well, the national shareholders meeting has occurred. Mr. Kerry has conceded to his friend, Mr. Bush. He's embraced Mr. Bush with the need to unite us and bring us all together. And the big problem, he said, is that there's a divide in this country. Is that really yes, there's a divide. There's a class divide. There's the 1% that owns 95%. And then there's a mass of our people who are in misery and starvation. I don't say that lightly. One out of four children live in poverty in the United States, and a child dies of hunger every 50 minutes in the United States. And these jokers are talking about the National Shareholders Meeting of November 2nd.
These elections just clearly show the inability of the Democrats to promote working class interests, just the basic ones. They failed to come out against the war after mobilizations of hundreds of thousands of people across this country marched on more than one occasion against this war. They opposed universal health care when 44 million Americans are uninsured. They approved the No Child Left Behind Act, which opens the door for privatization of the entire nation's public school system, and they failed to persecute the energy corporations for out-and-out stealing billions of dollars from taxpayers, pensioners, and workers. It's clear for all to see now, with this miserable watercolored campaign that Kerry ran that couldn't even excite the Wonder Bread Doughboy, it's clear that they will never be any amount of begging or pleading or hand-wringing that will ever be able to turn this rudder of the Democratic Party. What we truly need is to build that independent expression of the working class.
That's right, Doug. Didn't Schwarzenegger drop the lawsuits against the energy ripoff of California, and aren't we now paying for it? Doesn't the PUC keep raising our utility bills?
Oh, yes. Actually, you know, it's interesting about that because Warren Buffett guided Schwarzenegger then, as he did when the minimum wage was vetoed. John Kerry in his campaign was saying that he would support in certain states the increase of the minimum wage from $5 to $7 an hour. Now just think about what that means. $7 an hour? What is that, $56 a day? You're talking about under $12,000 a year? Does anybody in the right mind think that you can survive on this? Poverty now is defined as $17,000 for a family of four. What that means is that poverty is understood in the United States to be an income for an individual of $4,366. That's about what the Kerrys spend on lunch. I'm not joking about that. When you get the Kerry entourage into one of their restaurants, I'm not even talking about Bush, that's the lunch bill. This is a con. It's a fundamental con. The Democratic Party is the instrument of the banks and the corporations, no less than the Republican Party, and they are, look, much attention focused on what happens in the Senate and in the House of Representatives. Oh, the Republicans have gained four seats in the Senate. Well, brothers and sisters, the largest tax cut of the four that Mr. Bush introduced for the corporations was supported in the Senate by a vote of 93-4. The increase of troops in Iraq, supported by a vote of 94-3.
What about the Patriot Act, Ralph?
Similar vote. Kerry attacks the Patriot Act from the right. It's not strong enough. There are not enough provisions for preemptive strikes against the terrorists before they act, and they embrace the entire fiction. We'll kill them wherever they are. Mr. Obama, that's who. What, you hear on any number of programs. Well, we got Barack Obama into the Senate. Who got Barack Obama into the Senate? Mr. Barack Obama gave a talk 2 weeks ago in which he called for a preemptive missile strike on Tehran to be followed up by one in Karachi if there's any undermining of Musharraf in Pakistan. Mr. Obama said it's not a question but if but when, and we're all agreed on this, and Bush hasn't been sufficiently strong in preparing to take out Tehran. That's the same pitch that Cameron Kerry has given us. That's the same campaign that John Kerry waged about George Bush. Wrong war, wrong time, meaning you should have been going after them in Iran and North Korea and Afghanistan. They are part of this entire imperial corporate structure. Why then do we think that working people who are in crisis, where housing is not affordable? What does it cost for a one-bedroom apartment in New York City? More than working people make. Everybody's one paycheck away from being homeless. These are the realities, and they are going to be... When Kerry was challenged, when he said he's going to cut the deficit, this vast deficit for which the corporate tax cuts that the Democrats support are, of course, responsible. Oh, we're going to chop that deficit by $156 billion. So he said, well, how are you going to do that? I'm going to cut 2 million jobs from the federal payroll. What? The Democratic Party is going to attack the public sector workers in the United States. You're going to make PATCO look like a picnic. We have to be clear about these things. The Democratic Party is the instrument of corporate rule, and it is a vehicle through which we are co-opted and prevented from developing a struggle, and that's the heart and soul of the Million Worker Mobilization. That we mobilize in our own name, around our own agenda, and we build a political instrument expressive of that. Short of that, the longer you wait, brothers and sisters, the longer it takes.
Let me just show how this misrepresentation and double dealing that Ralph clearly describes at the national level takes place at our local level in Solano County. During this campaign to remove the touchscreen voting machines, we got a lot of press. We create a lot of heat. We were able to pressure the County Board of Supervisors to actually reverse their decision and get rid of these machines. That took place in large part because Kevin Shelley stepped out on a limb, stuck his neck out, and actually enforced the law, which clearly stated that the type of machine Solano County and three other counties had purchased violated a series of federal laws.
The Secretary of State.
The Secretary of State, yeah. So we get rid of these machines, and then what happens? So, well, our voter registrar quits. She's not fired. She quits and resigns. And they send out a call to replace this voter registrar who had brought in these machines, these touchscreen machines. Well, who applies? About four people, including the former salesperson from Diebold who sold the county the machines to begin with.
Wow.
And guess who's hired? She didn't come in through the front door, but she was hired. She came in through the back. We now have, working in our Office of Elections in Solano County, the person who sold us the touchscreen voting machines.
You're kidding, Doug.
No, no. And she in the papers and in the Fairfield paper had clearly stated that these machines were legal and conformed to every single state and federal law. But they didn't. She lied.
Have the machines been returned?
Yes, the machines were returned to Diebold. They bilked us of almost $500,000 because they had given them to us, and we used them in our March primary elections. So for $500,000, we got rid of the machines and had to invest in the optical scan equipment. Now, what it comes down to with all of this computer technology is just accountability. And the more accountability and the more open, the better this process can work. And in essence, what we need is we need to have the code that actually counts the vote to be owned by the state, by the public, so that we know how this mechanism works. To date, that hasn't happened anywhere in the United States. But I'm happy to say that Solano County is the only political jurisdiction in the country to have returned Diebold machines and gotten rid of an order of touchscreen machines.
Well, congratulations, Doug. I know that was a grassroots effort that you and Ralph and a lot of other people accomplished on your own, I might add. You're listening to Guns and Butter. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. I'm joined by Doug McDonald today. Doug McDonald is the founder of the Community Labor Alliance, and I'm also joined by Ralph Schoenman. Ralph is the co-producer of Taking Aim on BAI in New York. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, what do you say to people who are worried about Supreme Court justices? I hear this quite a bit. Ralph, weren't you pointing out to me that when Roe v. Wade passed the Supreme Court, it was voted for by justices who were appointed by a Republican government?
I think that's very much to the point, Bonnie. You know, the justice of the Supreme Court, Hugo Black, was a member of the Ku Klux Klan in his youth and had been in-your-face racist at the time of his appointment. Yet Hugo Black was later considered to be one of the defenders of civil liberties in the United States, and Earl Warren, who was a Republican governor in California, was the person who rounded up the Nisei, the Japanese Americans who were citizens of the United States, and put them in concentration camps. Now, the reason I mentioned that is because these same figures, under different circumstances, are defined as liberal justices of the court. And what that really means is the following. When you got a mass movement in the streets, such as the women's movement was, you get Roe v. Wade. The Republican justices who supported Roe v. Wade were very, very conservative figures when they were appointed by Republican presidents. It's not to say that Scalia and Clarence Thomas are going to be in the forefront of revolution, but what it does mean to say is that concessions in the form of reforms occur when we are mobilized in our own name independently of the two controlling parties. When we rely on our masters and on the bosses and define ourselves politically within their framework, they take back all those concessions ad seriatim. You cannot struggle for the defense of a woman's right to choose by picking and choosing amongst the corporate choices for office who they fund and control. Look carefully. What did John Kerry say in the Wall Street Journal on September 15th, in his article, My Economic Policy, A New CEO in Washington Would Be Good for American Business. What he said was, you need me to stabilize things, and you know, with a wink and a nod, that the people who are going to be running our policy are Warren Buffett, Lee Iacocca, Robert Rubin, and Owsley Brown of Chase Manhattan and Anheuser-Busch. Do you think that's confined to the economy? In the debate with Bush, Mr. Kerry told us that he had the support of General Zinni Shalikashvili and the head of the army, Eric Shinseki. Well, Mr. Zinni has recently said that you need between 400,000 and 500,000 troops in Iraq, not only with respect to Iraq, but with plans forward. When Kerry talks about the need to increase the troops by 40,000 and essentially Iraqization under U.S. control, is that a policy that isn't anything to do with a challenge to U.S. imperialism? Or is it the rationalization and the tactical embrace of U.S. imperialism? How can we be suckered into handing ourselves over to the war party, the party of corporate and banking capital, which has no fundamental difference with the Republican Party because they are the same people, the same fundamental class structure controls and owns both parties. One last point on this. We are not in an era in the decline of capitalist political economy today where the ruling class can give the trade union bureaucracy, the business unionists of Sweeney and Company, any concessions to hand to rank and file workers. See, this is a period of capitalism which in rapid decline, where it is not even able to tolerate the clients in Saudi Arabia and Iraq and in Syria and in Iran. No, they want direct control of these resources because of the declining rate of profit, and they're so addicted to the arms economy that they are unable to do anything except to plan for permanent war. Under these circumstances, any illusion that there is space within this corporate Democratic Party for so-called reformism is about 50 years out of date. It reflects a failure to perceive that this is the party of our oppression. And unless we build a political instrument of our own, and the million worker mobilization is precisely about that, is for addressing our needs, defining our agenda, mobilizing in our own name, taking this message to rank and file locals in every part of this country, galvanizing that sleeping giant, the vast, overwhelming majority of our citizens, 70% of whom look at this political process and say, ain't nothing out there for us. Same old, same old. They lie to us. When they get elected, they sell us out. They soft soap us at election time and sell us out every day in between. People feel that in their gut. They know it from their experience. And that is the great divide that we're going to bridge by mobilizing our constituency, which is the mass of our people. It's a process. You don't make a revolution like Nescafe, brothers and sisters. But until you set your foot on the path of providing a political agenda that offers people something for which they can struggle and provides the vehicle for doing that, you're locked into the John Kerrys and the Al Gores and the George Bushes in perpetuity.
Absolutely, Ralph. I mean, it is us. We are the ones we've been waiting for. It is our time to step up to the plate and to step forward and to really fill this void, the political void that exists here in this society. The million worker mobilization is key to that. It's a beginning. It's a fight back movement. We now have regional committees established throughout this nation. I encourage everyone to go to www.millionworkermarch.org. You will see some amazing updates over the next few weeks and months as we build and solidify this organization, as we reach out to U.S. Labor Against the War, as we reach out to brothers and sisters and all union locals across this great land. Again, just to show you another aspect of the power of when people join together in alliances with labor, with community organizations. They were trying to build a new city jail in my hometown of Benicia, California last year. It was going to cost $23 million once this measure to build the jail was all paid back. Well, at the same time, they were floating this bond idea. our school system was $3 million in the red. There was talk of it to be taken over by the state. We joined with the California School Employees Association, the janitors. We worked with the Teachers Association, and we fought that, jail, and we stopped that. And this election, it is still yet to be seen. We sponsored and promoted Measure S to give approximately $5 million over the next 3 years to our school system. So we can do these things, but it starts and takes time, and it starts with us.
I'm speaking with you've been listening to Doug McDonald, the founder of the Community Labor Alliance. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. We're also joined by Ralph Schoenman, co-producer of WBAI's Taking Aim. Do either of you have any opinion, or do you think it's significant at all that John Kerry conceded simply sort of the way Al Gore did last year? Neither one of them wanted to have all the votes counted. Does it matter?
It's reflective of the following. The Million Worker Mobilization, Bonnie, won the endorsement of international trade unions in the United States that represent nearly 4 million workers. I'm talking now about the National Educational Association, which at its national convention, 12,000 delegates had endorsed the Million Worker March. The American Postal Workers Union, representing 350,000 workers. The AFSCME district councils across the United States, SEIU 1199 in New York, the Transport Workers Union, and most significantly, black workers. Not just Black Workers for Justice, but the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists and Teamsters National Black Caucus, because African-American workers and Latino workers are in the cockpit of oppression in the United States. They reflect the most oppressed and exploited sector of the class. And the fact that this mobilization had such a significant leadership role of black workers, of Latino workers, of the immigrant rights organizations, the farm labor organizing committee, the fact that the anti-war movement, which, let's face it, has been largely a white middle-class movement, has conjoined with a working-class struggle, a trade union-based struggle, has profound implications for the building of a real class-based fight back in this society. That is the significance of the Kerry inability to challenge, even when his own band of brothers, as he calls them, is emasculated in front of our eyes. But let's look a little, just give me 1 second here, Bonnie, to tell a little bit about who this band of brothers is of which John Kerry speaks. How about Mr. Richard Morningstar, who was to be one of the chief national security advisors defining policy internationally for John Kerry. Mr. Morningstar was responsible for the Tbilisi to Ceyhan pipeline, in which he was joining with Chevron and Condoleezza Rice on behalf of the oil industry. He also had the responsibility for facilitating direct military control in Central Asia, a policy akin to that which is pursued by what are called the neocons. That's Richard Morningstar, and it's only the beginning of his contributions to corporate America. How about Rand Beers, who took over from Oliver North for Reagan in running FEMA? You talk about a prelude to the Patriot Act and the setting up of detention camps for potential dissidents. That's the desk of Oliver North and Rand Beers. Then he moves on does Mr. Rand Beers for Bush Sr. and even later for Clinton. What's he doing? He's running the right-wing death squads in Colombia by overseeing the support to the right-wing military in Colombia as it carries out its scorched earth policy against the peasants. And he gives direction for the destruction of the crops of the peasants across Colombia because they're the social base for the insurgency there. Mr. Rand Beers was a key figure in George W. Bush's homeland security apparatus. Along with Tom Ridge, it was Rand Beers who was responsible for the color coding for the so-called terror writs, and he is the key point man for a putative John Kerry administration on national security. And then we have William Perry, He's a doozy. William Perry was the chief lobbyist for Martin Marietta, who facilitated the merger with Lockheed, thank you very much, and is a director of the Carlyle Group, which is a who's who of the Republican Party and that corporate instrument of $14 billion that is involved in the everything from the BCCI to the Saudi families that are receiving money from Khalid al-Mahfouz, the brother-in-law of Osama bin Laden, whose last fake tape we were treated to on the eve of this election. Give me a break. Who's kidding who here, brothers and sisters? This is the biggest con job since Houdini. The Republican and Democratic parties, John Kerry and George Bush, are not just skull and bones brothers under the skin. They are the expression of a degenerate corporate gangster cabal that has captured and hijacked the political process in this society. As long as we mule on about how we didn't do enough to support John Kerry at the base, we will be incapable of reaching out to that mass of our people who've got more common sense than those of us who haven't learned that basic lesson that politics begins where your class interests lie. And if you don't find a way to give political expression to that, as you find in almost every other society in the world, you remain permanent captive to those who are cleaning our clocks. And this is not a spectator sport. This is a crisis that this society is facing because they are waging class war relentlessly at home. Flu vaccine. Remember now how that flu vaccine was shorted and contaminated? Look at the series in the San Francisco Chronicle as to what that was about.
I was just going to bring that up, Ralph. I've got that paper. Go ahead.
It was contaminated, all right, as the San Francisco... It's a remarkable series in the San Francisco Chronicle. I wish they'd done it at the time that the Pentagon was spraying Serratia marescens and the bacilli and the bacteria across the Bay Area. 40 years, the Pentagon has carried on a biological war against the people of the United States. It was articulated summed up in a remarkable book called Clouds of Secrecy by Leonard A. Cole, who was a professor of public health policy at Rutgers. It had an introduction, by the way, from Alan Cranston, the late senator from California. 139 civilian sites in the United States, the Pentagon was spreading bacteria, bacilli, that compromised the health of over 10 million people. In the Bay Area alone, there was a tenfold increase in brain and spinal meningitis, direct consequence. They put this stuff in the subway systems of New York. They put it in the school systems of Minneapolis. Why, you ask? Because the ruling class understands that their real enemy and the real threat is the mass of our people. A disaffected mass of our people confronted by a collapsing economy. And when does this house of cards collapse? Tomorrow? 6 months from now? 3.5 years from now? Resulting in the galvanization of that huge, vast mass of our people who see the electoral process as not having anything out there for them, but when confronted by the collapse of a system, are capable of rising to that occasion, as has been seen so often in our history. These steps by the Pentagon are part of class war against our people. The false flag of the terror apparatus is designed to provide for the suppression of our people. And the flu vaccine story, the dirty tale about that, is that that vaccine was compromised by Serratia marescens, the bacilli that the Pentagon distributed in the Bay Area that contaminated that vaccine, like the anthrax vaccine is contaminated, because most of the times these vaccines are not just profit-making operations, but they're experiments on the mass of this population, because it's war. It's not a science fiction story. Read the San Francisco Chronicle. We have to grasp the degenerative nature of this system, the venality and endless brutality of this gangster clique that has control over it, and why we are not engaged in an idle thing when we talk about the need to mobilize in our own name. It's life and death, brothers and sisters.
Ralph, if people want to check out that article in the San Francisco Chronicle, that's October 31st, and it starts on the first page. It's continued. It's quite lengthy about what they did in the 1950s to contaminating the entire Bay Area. It's interesting, I didn't realize that the flu vaccines were contaminated with the very same bacteria. I've been hearing a lot of predictions for months now, Ralph, almost 6 months, a prediction of a global influenza pandemic this winter. The first person who brought my attention to that was Ken Fernandez, who actually presented with you up in Toronto at the 9/11 Phase 2 Citizens Inquiry. His father was dying at the time, and he attended a health conference in Montreal in which a person from the CDC here in the United States gave a presentation saying that the CDC was predicting a global influenza pandemic this winter. And then, of course, we've seen a series of articles in the past few months. And just a few days ago, the World Health Organization came out with a report, same thing, predicting the same thing, another a flu pandemic. Of course, the influenza of 1918 killed millions and millions of people. And the latest WHO report was about avian flu. Now they're claiming that we're going to catch bird flu. This is really creepy.
Well, what we're really addressing here, I mean, after all, you have over the scale of the planet 2 billion people who live on less than a dollar a day, and endemic disease is a condition that is permanent. But one of the more distressing things about this is that the pharmaceutical industry, which is profiteering off of this, and all of their vaccines and all their drugs are dependent upon the presence of these illnesses, is very frequently instrumental in disseminating them. And that's not some vague imagining. Study after study has documented this. You mentioned the World Health Organization. You know, they undertook a putative vaccination program in Africa over a period of time. It was particularly centered in the Congo when Mobutu had allocated large sectors of the Congo to the World Health Organization and to the Center on Disease Control. And they carried out what were purporting to be vaccinations. On the front page of the London Times, Bonnie, I believe it was an investigative piece around 1989, they did a grid. They put a grid map over the precise areas where these so-called vaccination programs were enacted in Central Africa. One-to-one correlation with the emergence of AIDS clusters. Now, that's a whole subject in itself. But the medical industrial complex, after all, we were talking a moment before about the Carlyle Group, Rumsfeld and all these people, pharmaceutical industry is absolutely at the head of the multi-billion dollar profiteering that takes place in this country. And the pharmaceutical industry is wholly dependent upon the manufacture and sale of these vaccines. Take a look at what happened to the Gulf War veterans when they were required to have a so-called anthrax vaccine that was linked to a company called Bioport. Bioport takes us right back to the Carlyle Group. Also, I should point out that the head of Bioport, who was Admiral William Crow, was the chief of staff of Bill Clinton and the ambassador to London, who was instrumental in the captive privatization and takeover of the Port and Downs facility in Great Britain. These anthrax contaminated vaccines were imposed upon USGIs, hundreds of thousands of them. There's a one-to-one correlation between that and the so-called Gulf War syndrome. Look at the site of the Gulf War veterans against the war. Over 200,000 GIs now affected by both depleted uranium and the anthrax vaccinations with systemic neurological disorders. Take this to the way in which biological warfare is waged by U.S. imperialism in whole regions of the world. There's a 250,000 times increase in radiation now in Iraq over that which existed in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. These are not random data. This is the criminal nature of a system that is waging class war on the most disadvantaged, the destruction of our capacity to organize ourselves, and the exploitation of our health crises for the sake of profit is absolutely inherent in the way corporate capitalism works today, administered and supported and promoted and enacted by both the Democratic and Republican parties and their satraps. Is a permanent national security apparatus, be it Rand Beers, be it Oliver North, be it Richard Morningstar, be it Condoleezza Rice, be it William Perry and his Carlyle group with Frank Carlucci. Yes, this is a system that is waging war against the mass of our people and peoples across the planet and working people, people who are at the bottom of our society. The overwhelming majority of our citizens are the real targets. If we don't develop a political instrument and a fight back, the human cost will be vast, even greater than we've experienced up to now. Forget about our democratic rights, brothers and sisters. We all know they're under assault, but identify those who are carrying out the war, and let's build our own fight back struggle, because short of that, we are nothing but victims who stand by while Kerry concedes the stolen election, and he embraces with his brother Bush about bringing unity to our people and overcoming the divide. What is that divide? It's the divide between the many and the rapacious few. That divide is permanent. That divide is inherent. That divide is characteristic of a rapacious capitalism. We need to build a political fight back. That's what Guns and Butter is about. That's what the Million Worker Mobilization was set up to address.
You know, Bonnie, this may sound a little bit out of line, and I understand if people disagree and are taken aback today with the Republican president firmly entrenched in power now. But what it shows us, and I'm very optimistic about this, is it shows us there's an opening. The Democratic Party could not even defeat one of the greatest buffoons who've ever has sat in that office. It was the easiest thing in the world just to put it out there, his lies, deceptions, but they didn't. Why? Because it's not who they represent. It is contrary to their political beliefs and to the people who actually fund and steer this Democratic Party to really tell the truth about how the politics in this country work, about how our foreign policy works, about how our domestic policy is shaped. They do not want a mobilization of people on the streets. That's why Al Gore said, I lost in 2000. That is why Kerry today announced early, before even consulting people on the ground, unilaterally says, I've lost. They do not want a mobilization of people. Why? Because when we mobilize, especially when we mobilize independent of these two parties, in our own name, that is where we gain strength.
Yes, as Ralph has pointed out, even an imbecile like Bush couldn't get beaten by the Democrats. With this disaster in Iraq, with giving billions of our dollars away to billionaires, they couldn't even defeat him.
They had a victory served to them on a silver platter, and they just threw it aside.
Well, after all, you have to continue to remind people, I think, that the Democratic Party and John Kerry waged the campaign far to the right.
Yes.
We're going to kill all the terrorists. Bush hasn't been strong enough in doing that. All the terrorists are going to be taken out by us. Now, the category of terror is the rationale for the addiction to arms. Mm-hmm. There was no basis for continuing this total addiction to arms that could be sold to the American people with the collapse of the Soviet Union. The false category of terror was the vehicle through which this was accomplished, and every internal memorandum of the National Security Council bears this out. We need a new Pearl Harbor, said Condoleezza Rice. The false category of terror, the contrivance of 9/11, the invention of a demon afar, a couple of hundred feudal satraps of the Central Intelligence Agency are now everywhere. They're omnipresent. They're going to sneak into our drawers, and they're going to explode everything that they can to which they can gain access. Talk about your ultimate conspiracy theory. It's interesting, by the way, in this latest October surprise, when they the latest tape of Bin Laden, the first one that we've often discussed on Doug's platforms at Community Labor Alliance and on Guns and Butter. The first Bin Laden tape was a scissors and paste job in which this man at a wedding ceremony was presented as congratulating people, then the CIA telling us that they were assailants of 9/11. The second tape was supposed to have happened at Kandahar during the full moon of Ramadan, and there was no full moon during Ramadan in that particular year. Another scissors and paste job, a total fabrication, and this current one, this current Bin Laden tape, I'd like to know his plastic surgeon, by the way, because those wrinkles disappeared pretty good. But beyond that, as the Arab press has been pointing out, Mr. Bin Laden is telling us that he was inspired by the attack on the towers of Beirut in 1983. 1983, that's what gave him the motivation for the putative attacks on the World Trade Center. He was still in the pay of the Central Intelligence Agency, busy in Afghanistan.
That's right.
Never occurred, as the Lebanese press said. My goodness, if that was his concern, how come they didn't organize something in Tel Aviv? No, it is so fatuous. Leaving aside the fact that in this most recent tape they're invoking Mohammed Atta. Mohammed Atta was trained at a U.S. military installation with crypto security clearance. I mean, everywhere you touch this thing, but. The false category of terror to whipsaw the American people into a numbed acquiescence into this brutal imperial agenda is embraced by all sectors of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, and by not a few people who pass themselves off as, what can I call them, members of the liberal community and the left. They embrace the whole apparatus. They parse the significance of the release of the Bin Laden tape without ever addressing the total fraudulence of it or the nature of this 9/11 charade. As long as we are locked into the ideological terrain of our class enemy, there is no way to expose before the American people the magnitude of the crime that is being visited upon us.
Ralph, speaking of Mohammed Atta and Osama Yumama, I wanted to invite all of our friends to an event this coming Saturday night that's in San Francisco at Theater Artaud at 450 Florida, San Francisco. This is Saturday, November 6th, so this is this coming Saturday night from 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. You're going to give a talk there at 7 p.m., Ralph. Let's see, what does it say? Ralph Schoenman on the hijackers' ties to the U.S. military. Also presenting will be pilot Michael Dietrich on the 9/11 flight paths and stand down. Everybody's heard Michael Dietrich here on Guns and Butter. Don Paul is going to present on the profiteers behind the war on terror. And also Jim Hoffman will be presenting on the World Trade Center buildings demolition. And you've heard Jim Hoffman here on Guns and Butter. That's this Saturday night, Theater Artaud in San Francisco, 450 Florida, San Francisco, 7 to 11. I wish I had a phone number. Oh, here's a phone number. 510-232-19999.
What an appropriate venue, Theater Artaud, you know, the great surrealist and author of The Theater of the Absurd. It's certainly appropriate when you address the lies of 9/11. But, you know, Bonnie, I was thinking as you were speaking just now, I remember when we were in the process of attempting to build a labor party in the United States, we had something called Labor Party Advocates, and there was a conference in Detroit. And a discussion ensued amongst those who had illusions about pressuring the Democratic Party to the left. And one of the activists in that effort, a woman named Elaine Bernard, who teaches labor history now at Harvard, stood up on that platform and she said, you know, brothers and sisters, you can't suck and blow at the same time. Elaine Bernard hit it on the head, brothers and sisters. We got to choose between defending our own interests with our own political instrument or forever entertaining the illusion that the John Kerrys of this world are an alternative. Let's get forward with the struggle for real and political emancipation. join us.
Thank you, Ralph Schoenman. Thank you, Doug McDonald.
Thank you,
I'm Bonnie Faulkner.
Thank you,
this is Guns and Butter. Give us a call, 510-848-6767, extension 628, www.gunsandbutter.net. Give me an email, faulkner@gunsandbutter.net, or get a hold of Ralph at takingaim@packbell.net or www.takingaim.info. Thank you very much. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Doug, and thanks, Bonnie.
Hey, yo, I don't think they heard you, Steve. Kick it to him again one more time.
It's time we stop, children. What's that sound?